So, once again, thank you all for being here. I'm proud to introduce our speaker for today, Miri Eisen. Colonel Miri Eisen, she's retired from the Israel Defense Forces now, served as Deputy Head of the Combat Intelligence Corps, Assistant to the Director of Military Intelligence, and as an intelligence officer in combat and research units in the Israel Defense Forces. She also served as the Israeli government spokesperson during the Second Lebanon War in 2006, and as International Press Secretary to Prime Minister Ehud Olmert during the Annapolis peace process with Palestinians that was based here in Maryland in the United States. She earned a BA from Tel Aviv University, an MA in Security Studies from Haifa University, and is a graduate of the Israeli National Defense College. And she's currently working on a doctorate at Haifa University, right?
Trying.
because you have all this free time from traveling to the U.S. and speaking to us, writing her dissertation on political narratives and postmodern conflicts. She has broad and deep experience with Israeli culture, politics, and the military, and she's also a warm and generous person to come and speak to us today. So it's my pleasure to welcome Miri, and thank you all for being here.
This is just my favorite crowd. So good afternoon to everybody. What's not written in the bio, so I'm going to add in some more additional biographical pieces. I was born in the States, in California, but in the Bay Area, which is like a different world, different country. My parents immigrated to Israel in 1971, so I've been there for over 40 years. And I say that in the background because I know that I sound very American and I'm through and through Israeli. And don't be fooled by my American accent. I'm a retired colonel. I've already been out of the military for 10 years. And I point that out also because I'm going to be talking about different events that are happening within the military, and some of them have happened since my being in service. And what I want to try and open it up right now with this group and what we're talking about, and I'm going to get to what you're saying also on the screen behind me in this issue of religious diversity, is first I want to do an equalizer and give you a little bit of background because the Israeli military is not really like any other one, and I do need to do an equalizer. So here we are, it's 2014. State of Israel is a state that has 8 million citizens. Of our 8 million citizens of the State of Israel 2014, 75% are Jews. I'll talk about what that means in a moment, because that doesn't mean Jews, okay? Those are religious Jews. 75% are Jews. This isn't a religious distinction that they're traditional practicing. It's a distinction of what their background is. 21% of Israeli citizens are Arab Muslims. And 4% of Israeli citizens, and this is according to the Central Bureau of Statistics of Israel, and I adore the CBS website. They have an enormous amount of information about Israel, which is always concurrent. And it says there that 75% Jews, or whatever the number is, 21% Arab Muslim, and the 4% are defined as other. And the reason that in Israel it's defined as other is because it's made up out of a very diverse group of different religions, ethnicities, some that you've heard of and some that you haven't necessarily heard of. And in Israel, the equalizer to a certain degree is the military. Israel is 65 years old. We were established in 1948. And from the establishment in May of 1948, in the midst of a very bloody civil war, which then became a war between the very new state of Israel and the Arab states around us, because there was first initially a civil war under the British-Palestinian authority, and then after that, Palestinian authority, but under the Brits, and then it became a war between a state and other states, State of Israel immediately enacted the draft. State of Israel was declared on May 14th, 1948. And they enacted the draft on June 1st, 1948. Now, before that, they already had a draft that was kind of voluntary, meaning you're part of us and we need to fight and otherwise we're not going to exist. But as soon as the state, the members, declared it, they made the draft. And when they made the draft, they said that the draft was for everybody. Now let's get into the everybody. Because from the beginning in 1948, there were certain groups in society that were exempt. And that has stayed with us in the 65 years of the existence of the State of Israel. Now, in 1948, when the state was established, when it was established in May of 1948, when they passed that law in June of 1948, the majority of Israelis were Jews. And in those Jews, a higher percentage than it is now. Okay, I said that now it's 75%. And in the Jews at that time, there was a clear distinction that the State of Israel that was declared and established in May of 1948 was done so by the relatively secular Jews who are cultural Jews, heritage Jews, traditional Jews, but not religious Jews. And even within the religious Jews that supported the idea of a Jewish democracy, the little portion of the Jews at that time that were kind of on the side of that were the ultra-Orthodox Jews. And I'm saying those distinctions because those distinctions exist in Israeli society to this day. And I'm getting back to the Central Bureau of Statistics. They, in Israel, you're allowed to ask these questions. I know that in the States you're not allowed anyways. It's like they'll call you up and say, what are you? And they'll ask you, what do you define yourself as? Jewish, Arab? And they have these different Jewish, Arab, Muslim. Just think about the nuances of asking that question. I'm going to put that one aside for the moment. But once you said you're Jewish, and I said 75% of Israeli citizens are Jewish, the follow-up question that they're asking you to define yourself is to put yourself into one of four categories. And how do you define yourself? And think of how you define yourself, okay? Because at the end, the Central Bureau of Statistics, that's the categories that they give us. And they ask, do you define yourself as a secular Jew, as a traditional Jew, as an Orthodox Jew, or as an ultra-Orthodox Jew? Those are the distinctions in Israeli society of Jews. They don't ask if you're Reform or Conservative. The terms that you've probably heard more of the Jewish North American population, because pretty much two-thirds of the North American Jewish population are either Reform or Conservative. More Reform, because that's a much larger number. In Israel, the traditional and even secular, let alone the Orthodox and ultra-Orthodox Jews, none of them are Reform or Conservative. The Jews who don't practice Judaism don't practice the Orthodox and ultra-Orthodox form, not the Reform and Conservative, okay? And it's a distinction because it has to do also part with how we view also what goes on, because I can say many things about modern Orthodox and ultra-Orthodox, but they do not have within their religion equality for women, okay? And the Reform and Conservative pretty much have full equality. Now I get into the distinctions of Israel and the military. From the beginning, the military was defined as egalitarian. From the beginning, in the 1948 war, 65 years ago, there were women fighting in infantry units. There were women officers. Women were part of the fighting forces because at the time, again, that social egalitarian ethos, which very much established the State of Israel, was also part of the military ethos. And I want to get to 2014 because on the one hand, it's the same, and on the other hand, it isn't. Should I also move back?
Good.
We're okay?
Good.
All right. And the different groups and ethnicities that make up the State of Israel, in 1948, the Prime Minister at the time, the one who declared the State of Israel, Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion, who I always love seeing statues of him because he's really cute. He had this bushy hair on both sides so that whenever you see him, it's very distinctive. It's very easy to draw him as a kid because, excuse me, I came from the States. He looks like Bozo the Clown. You know, it's that kind of tufts of hair that are on both sides. Not orange, but it's very similar in that idea. And when David Ben-Gurion declared the state, he was already with that tufty kind of hair on both sides. He was already older. And when they declared the state at the time, they had a dialogue about the draft. And the issue was everybody has to be drafted because we're just established. We're a small amount of people. We need everybody on board. We need the men. We need the women. We need the religious. We need the ethnicities. From the beginning, they got separate ethnic groups to be part of this new Jewish force, but the Druze, which is one of these ethnic communities, already drafted into the Israeli military in 1948. I mean, it wasn't just the Jews. And they approached the issue of the ultra-Orthodox. And the picture behind me is not ultra-Orthodox, those are modern Orthodox. And the reason the ultra-Orthodox are not in the picture is from 1948 in dialogue, not in compulsory, in talking with the heads then of the ultra-Orthodox Jewish community, David Ben-Gurion and his staff agreed that the ultra-Orthodox are not going to be drafted. And the reason they're not going to be drafted in 1948 was two. One was the egalitarian issue. You draft the ultra-Orthodox, you immediately have an issue with the women because they don't go hand in hand, and I'm going to expand on that because that's part of our challenge right now. But the other aspect at the time is one which is not easy, and I'm putting it on the table. I want you to be aware of it. In the Holocaust, it was enough for you to be a quarter Jewish to be killed by Hitler, okay? You could look like me and you, and we'd be killed by Hitler. But obviously, it's a lot easier to hide your Jewishness in 1940 if you look like you and me than if you look like an ultra-Orthodox Jew. Okay, to be an ultra-Orthodox Jew, to do that transition, you'd have to cut off the sideburns and you'd have to dress very differently. Okay, the way they look, they immediately look different. And the ultra-Orthodox Jewish community was decimated like all other Jewish communities and even more, because it was so clear-cut, easy to see who they were. And the State of Israel in 1948 said, you know what, they, in dialogue with them, they said, we want to rehabilitate ourselves, we want to rebuild ourselves, we want to go back into the yeshiva. There was a whole big issue about where was God, but let's not go into that whole thing with what went on and what the terms are of the Holocaust. And it was decided in 1948 to give the ultra-Orthodox a full exemption for military service. And that was fine when they were 0.5% of the Jews. From 1948 until 2013, I mean, now we're in 2014, but this was the main issue in the Israeli elections of January a year ago. They grew from 0.5% to 1%, from 1% to 2%. Who's in math here? You're all a poli-sci. From 2% to 4%, from 4% to 8% of the Jews. And right now, we are in the stage where they're going from 8% to, that's right, 16%. They're around 10% now of the Jews. Somebody have to tell me if that's the geometrical or mathematical equation. I never remember which one it is, because it's not 1, 2, 3, 4. It's 1, 2, 4, 4, 8, 16. But it came up as an issue of civil human rights. Because when they were 0.5% and they were exempt, they were doing something, you were doing something, it was kind of acceptable. But as the numbers went on and up, it meant that there's a whole segment of Jewish society that is not doing the Israeli draft service. We still have the draft. It's 2014. We never canceled the draft. You canceled the draft in the 1970s. Of the modern Western countries of Europe, Central South America in that sense, we're the only country on earth that has the draft for women. Okay? We're the only modern Western country that the draft is 36 months for men. That's 3 years. That's not a little time. That's your undergraduate degree, okay? For women, it's 24 months. It's not the same for men and for women. And that's part of the issues on the table, because as soon as you have that discrepancy where women are drafted for less time than men, then the positions that they get are different, than what they do within the military is different. And that's, so you want to try and address it, because there are immediate both good things and bad things that happen when you serve in the Israeli military, because the Israeli military, everybody goes. Everybody goes except for who's exempt. So the ultra-Orthodox are exempt, and that's a number that went from basically 0.5% to 10%. That became an enormous issue in Israeli politics. Second group that was exempt from 1948 and is still exempt to this day are the Arab Muslim citizens of Israel. I mentioned before that 21% of citizens of the State of Israel are Arab Muslim. They're full equal citizens of the State of Israel, but they're not drafted. They're not drafted because at the end of the day, we're not the United States of America. We don't fight once in Asia and then in Africa and then in Europe. I mean, again, at the end, you're the United States of America. Don't underestimate who you are. We are a country where the neighbors that we have, sadly, the enemy that we've had, sadly, and I say this very sadly, has basically been the Arabs. And in 1948, it was like, you're not going to draft the Arab citizens of Israel to fight what is essentially their family. Over the years, that distinction has also been, it's still generally so. There are segments of the Arab-speaking population, including the Muslim population, that are both drafted or volunteer into the military. And what that means at the end is that the military has within it, the bulk of the military are what you would call traditional secular Jews, or what I'm going to call non-practicing Jews. We'll talk, but the Judaism that they don't practice is the Orthodox one. Okay, so that's one aspect. In addition to that, you have ethnic groups that are both drafted or volunteered, and there isn't a special unit for those and a different unit for those. Everybody's together. And the military has very much become, over the 65 years of the existence of the State of Israel, it's a segue. It's like a way that, it's a conduit that takes you from one place and takes you out into another, and it can really change the situation of people who are coming from less privileged areas. You know, they can do well, they can get forward. And as I say that, it has both its upside and its downside, like with everything. And what we have had over the last 10 years has been an enormous change, and I want you to look at the picture there. Because when we looked at the numbers of Jews in Israel, for many, many years, Israeli Jews were overwhelmingly what you would call secular or traditional. I mean, the synagogue they didn't go to was the Orthodox one, but they didn't go to it. They lived their life in the Jewish sense, not necessarily through the Jewish way of thought that you actually can study here, okay? But they live it through the Jewish calendar, the Jewish heritage, the Jewish culture, the Jewish language. That's a lot of things. And I want to take you back to high school. You guys got into BC. That's a good school. Okay. When you were in high school, probably in and around your junior year, you were already thinking about where you would go and if BC was your first choice. I don't know. Okay. That was something that you were thinking about. And you guys all got into here because you all introduced yourselves and you all got into here, right? In Israel, in your junior year, you get your first draft notice. And the regular Israeli debate around the high school table is not what did I get in my SATs, and am I going to go to the college of my choice, and what's my fallback position, and am I going to be close to home or on the other side of the continent to get as far away from home? I have both at this table, right? Okay? Depending if you want to go home in Israel, in terms, it's for Friday night dinner with your mom and dad or not. In Israel, you can never get very far away. I want to remind you, physically, we're very close. In Israel, in your junior and senior year, the discussions in high schools, in the regular, again, in the secular, in the traditional, and in the modern Orthodox, is where are you going to go in your military service? And it's a discussion that the women have, and it's a discussion that the men have. And what Israel did in the last 20 years, because of rulings of the Israeli Supreme Court about the issue of equality, is they gradually have try to completely equal out. I don't always remember the exact word, so I invent them, so you'll understand me, but if there's a better term, you'll tell me. But to make equal the women's service and the men's service, which means that in Israel, women are in combat units. But in Israel, you have the draft. So men don't have a choice. If they fit the medical profile, they'll be sent to a combat unit. They don't ask them. They may ask them which combat unit you'll go to, but they don't get to say, no, I don't want to do combat. This isn't about volunteering into the military. So that you can get a 17, 18-year-old kid who's drafted, and he was put in the armored corps. It's not exactly what he wanted to do with his life. He's put in the artillery. I don't say that he was put in the infantry, because the infantry brigades overwhelmingly get people who volunteer into them, meaning people want to go into the infantry brigades. They don't want to go as much into the armored corps. They don't want to go as much into the artillery. Nowadays, with Xbox and PlayStations, more of them want to go into the artillery because the artillery is not artillery. It is very high-tech, playing games that sadly at the end can kill people, but it's very similar to a lot of the games that I see my kids play at home. Okay, you know, like you sit with all of these things, you walk in, it's very similar. It's not as different as you think. And I say that because when you arrive at that age of 18, what Israel has done over the last 20 years is we've tried to address the issue of the equality for women, of bringing in women in, because everybody does it, except for those who don't. But because everybody does it, the more that the women are equal there, the more they'll be equal also in society after that, in politics, in civic society, in being leaders, and in Israel. And you have this problem everywhere else, okay? When the men do it and the women don't do it, it can have implications. In Israel, the shortcut into Israeli politics was being in the military. But our demographics have changed. And what's happened inside the IDF is, on the one hand, they brought up many more women. I didn't get colonel because of that, but I was certainly part of a trend at the time where they were trying to promote more women. Of the colonels in the IDF, less than 2% of the colonels are women. 98% of the colonels are men, and I'm a colonel. So it isn't an easy group to get into. When you go up to brigadier general, it goes down to 1%. Meaning 99% of all of the generals that have been in the IDF are men, and 1% are women. There are more Druze colonels and generals than there are women. And the Druze are like 150,000 in all of Israel, and as far as I noticed in Israel, women are half of the society. So we still have challenges within that. The different ethnic groups, the different religious groups have also been incorporated into it. And over the last 10 years, we've had the dialogue about the incorporation of both the modern Orthodox and the ultra-Orthodox into the military. So the modern Orthodox have always been drafted. The difference in Israeli society between the modern Orthodox and the ultra-Orthodox, I'd kind of give it as the chicken and the egg. For modern Orthodox, they are active participants in the nation state of Israel, and they are religious. The ultra-Orthodox run their life from A to Z according to the religious group that they're in, and they're in the state of Israel. Okay? They, to a large degree, they're not one, but the ultra-Orthodox in general are self-segregated. They live in separate neighborhoods by choice. They want to live within their community because their communal life is what runs their life. The religious communal life is the important part. The fact that they're citizens of Israel or some other place, that's to the side. The ultra-Orthodox throughout the years very much knew how to use their political pivotal point to gain political capability. But when it comes to the military throughout the years, it was like, we're not part of the military. You don't want us in the military. Let's not be part of the military. Nobody ever thought of drafting the ultra-Orthodox women. But with the men, it became this huge issue. And I come back to 10 years ago where it became an issue with the Supreme Court of the State of Israel, because the Supreme Court was petitioned and it said, in Israel we have a basic law, we don't have a constitution, we have a basic law, which is the basic law of equality, which means we have equal rights for men and women, equal rights for different ethnic groups, equal, that you are a citizen, you get absolute equality. And somebody petitioned the Supreme Court and said, how come I'm drafted into the IDF in the ultra-Orthodox movement? And the Israeli Supreme Court, a decade ago, gave a ruling. We have a very active Supreme Court. And they said, Mrs. Legislator, get your act together. This is unconstitutional, even though we don't have a constitution, but we have basic laws. This is against one of the basic laws. You have to address the fact that you're giving an exemption to a group based on nothing. Either draft them or legislate something in the legislator that gives them an exemption, but you have to address it. It can't just be that the government gives them an exemption. It has to be addressed because it's contradicting the basic equality rights of the citizens of the State of Israel. Ladies and gentlemen, for the last 10 years, we've been in a legislative process where they have not arrived at an agreed terminology which would not throw out the equality of the women in the IDF, together with the incorporation of a group which are much more religious than these. Now, the modern Orthodox have been in the IDF from the beginning. They have become a growing proportion of the IDF. The IDF is the Israeli Defense Forces. It's just the term that I use for like the military in general. And the IDF draft men and women, draft modern Orthodox. And our numbers are the way our military is right now has kind of changed also religiously. Until around 20 years ago, in the officers' corps of the Israeli military, 1 in 4 military officers were from that social egalitarian kind of background, from the kibbutz. Has everybody heard the term kibbutz, which doesn't really exist today, but it is a social, it would be the beautiful idea of what communism would be if it really could work. And you try to do it with 300 people, it might work. You try to do it with the state, it doesn't work as well. But the kibbutzim gave an enormous amount of the officers, completely disproportionate to the amount that they were in Israeli society. In the last 20 years, gradually, 1 in 4 military officers are modern Orthodox. What does that mean? How do they treat women? Do they feel equal? Do they feel comfortable? And we started to see already within the military with the modern Orthodox all sorts of changes and limitations on how they address. And again, we have the draft. It's not like the woman has the choice or the man, the secular man, and they walk in and there are little changes where they want it to be more religious. But wait a second, who says it's religious at all? But that's one of our distinctions of how do you, it's a slippery path.
They want what to be more religious?
They want the military to be more religious, because the military, it isn't that it was a haven of secularism, but it was a place where you left the religion outside, you walked inside the door, you could be religious, you could practice your religion, but you didn't impose it on anybody else. It was like that's, which was always the difference between the modern Orthodox and the ultra-Orthodox, that it's my thing and I take care of it, and if I have to go fight on Saturday or, you know, the holidays or whatever, that's part of what I do. I'm not going to stop because it's Saturday, and that's still to this day. But the group pressure has brought in now that they're not willing to have women in certain positions, that they're finding this issue of women commanders. Of, for example, the biggest example, and I want to give this here because it's very different from what you have, again, anywhere else, because we have the draft. They wanted to try and give all sorts of different opportunities to people who are drafted who, you know what, they don't want to be fighters or soldiers, and it's more diverse. Everybody's drafted. So we have theatrical groups. That's what you can do as your military service. You're drafted, and you get accepted to the military theater for 3 years. And for 3 years, you present plays to the other soldiers, okay? That's men and women. You also have entertainment groups that are men and women. And the modern Orthodox soldiers and officers over the last 5 years have said, we don't want to hear women singing. So these are issues that are coming up now where you see it's kind of like, so wait a second, so what, are you going to leave the room? So we're not going to have entertainment anymore? So what are the women supposed to do? And now we get to the ultra-Orthodox. Because it's the crux. It's like coming there and everybody's waiting to see what it's going to be. When they draft in that 10%, that's thousands of ultra-Orthodox a year into the IDF. Ultra-Orthodox men, we're not talking about the women. Ultra-Orthodox men, by religion, cannot be alone in a room with a woman. I'm going to respect that. Oh, so I can't be with ultra-Orthodox soldiers? I'm saying, I'm a colonel. Served my entire life in the Israeli Defense Forces. My entire adult life, right? That career, been in a few since. But it raises all sorts of questions. Now, what they did over the last decade when they started to just draft a bit of the ultra-Orthodox is they made ultra-Orthodox units. Because again, you kind of, on the one hand, you want to respect it, so you want to accommodate it, and on the other hand, how far do you go? It's a very challenging issue inside Israeli society. So we have right now two battalions. I don't know if you know military, but it's like a battalion itself is probably going to be 1,000 people, okay? We have two battalions that are made up, 1,500 people, that are made up entirely of ultra-Orthodox. That means that there are no women in those battalions. So that's cute when you have two battalions and you have other dozens of battalions that are mixed. Because at the end, women are drafted, same way. But how do you balance that out now if suddenly you need, what, you're going to build now 20 battalions where there are no women? What does that do to that issue within Israeli, both society and inside the military? And I don't have the results for you. I don't know the solution. We're right in the middle of the process right now of trying to understand, do you do it in dialogue? Or do you impose it on them? And the last point I'll make is that in the last 48 hours in Israel, we have had an additional Supreme Court ruling and implementation by the government on a portion of this issue, which said that the religious ultra-Orthodox who aren't going to the military, what they're going is they're going to a religious institution which is called a yeshiva. That's where they go. And it's funded by the state. And the Supreme Court on Tuesday said, okay, guys, we've been waiting 10 years for your legislation. You haven't gone through. We, the Supreme Court, now say that the government cannot fund these institutions if they are not doing some sort of equal service that you guys define and you haven't defined, so you have to stop the funding. And I looked at that on Tuesday, because on Tuesday I also met Eric, and I looked at that on Tuesday and I said, right, sure, of course, okay? Today the finance minister cut off the funding to the yeshivot. Today we are now, you know, in Israel right now, it's 7:30 p.m. Throughout this day, the ultra-Orthodox, not the modern Orthodox, the ultra-Orthodox have been out on the streets protesting the cutting off of the funding to their religious institutions. What are they saying? What, are they going to draft us? They're not going to make us draft it. And that there's always that question, do you do it through dialogue? Do you impose it? There is no easy answer on this one, by the way, because if you don't impose it, it's never going to happen. And when you impose it, there are going to be demonstrations. But if you don't impose it, then it's never going to make a decision. They made a decision right now, so we're right in the midst of it. So I've given you a little bit of an overview of just some of the different issues that we have on the table right now. We have the draft. A little under 70% of Israeli 18-year-old men are drafted. The 30% that are not drafted are the ultra-Orthodox and the Arab citizens of Israel. There are portions of them that are, but as a bulk, the Arab Muslims are not drafted. In the women, 50% of the women, 18-year-old women in Israel are drafted. And it's like, you don't have the equivalent. And again, nobody has the equivalent. And the reason that only 50% as opposed to the almost 70% with the men is because the modern Orthodox women have been exempt for many years also from the draft. Again, it's how you relate to the different cultural, religious respectabilities of, for them, for women, religious women, to be alone in a room with a man on the other side of the spectrum, or to be exposed to the hedonistic lifestyle, right, of the IDF. It's not, I mean, at the end, it's kind of like college. Because for the draftees, I want to remind you, they have the exact same hormones of the 18 to 22-year-olds that you get here in the undergraduate degrees, okay? Only in Israel, they're being drafted into the military. So that there is that issue, which can be similar to separate dorms, mixed room. Co-ed. Just think of all of those kind of issues that you have here. And in Israel, that's the age where everybody's being drafted and in the military. And when you add in the religious spice, and I said the modern Orthodox are becoming more conservative. And so that's an added challenge on how you relate to that in something which is supposed to be kind of open for everybody, and you both want respect and have dialogue and that the rule of law, and to try to make it as equal as possible. So that's called my opening remarks. You get to ask about this or about anything else you want to. Feel free. I never know exactly where I'm going to go on those sort of things, so I've arrived wherever I am.
Thanks. We have a good half hour for conversation, and the floor really is open, whether it's about religion and state or military relations or what.
Just a real quick data question. You said 10% of the current Jewish population is ultra-Orthodox. Of the Jews.
Yes.
Yeah. What of that group, what percent are Orthodox, traditional, secular, roughly?
Again, the 10% is the ultra-Orthodox.
Right.
I'll take the 75% Jewish.
Yep.
Now I'm turning them into 100%.
Okay.
When you break them down, 10% define themselves as secular. 70% define themselves as traditional. 10% is modern Orthodox, and 10% is ultra-Orthodox. Okay? And I did a statistic game there because I took the 75% and made that 100%. Okay? And again, it's a very personal answer, how you would define yourself. You're looking at somebody and she's totally secular, but I would define myself as traditional. Because I do certain things. I don't not do anything in Jewish tradition. And again, it's each to his own. And my husband would define himself as secular. And yet we're married and we have 3 kids and we get along and we do fine. And I would say we're traditional and he would say we're secular. So I think many Israelis are like me, where they define themselves as traditional, even though they don't, meaning that the traditional is probably a lot more of what you would call secular than what you think. Okay?
Andrea, I'm in here.
So it's a matter of self-identity. I'm wondering if in the past the ultra-Orthodox who have not been drafted, they have not been drafted on the basis of their self-identification as ultra-Orthodox, and whether there's going to be any change in that with the legislation, if there's going to have to be, you know, in this country, you know, we have all these means of supposedly approving whether you're exempt or eligible for certain things, and I'm wondering if that's something that's going to be imposed with the new legislation.
So we've had, from around 1980, we've had a sub-law for the women. A woman who says that she can't serve because she's religious doesn't serve. And they wanted to go check how many women were declaring, that's what it's called in Israel, is that you declare that you're religious. Were they just using that as a way to get out of the draft? So we already have that in effect. And what's happened over the years, it's more complex than just the military. Because the exemption that the ultra-Orthodox were given was one, it's so bad, I hate even putting it on the table, where not only were they exempt, but they were accredited as if they had served. Meaning they were getting all of the benefits that Israelis get from serving without serving. Why? Because what they were saying is, I'm going into the religious institution, the yeshiva, that the yeshiva is the equivalent of the military service. I go to religious institution, you do military service. We're each giving what we can give to the state of Israel. Now, I think it's a lot nicer to go to a religious institution than into the military. The military is not an easy, no matter how we paint it, and that it's such an important part of our lives, it's never easy. And if from the religious institution they would go work, then the Israeli authorities would find that out, and they would be sent to be drafted, right? So not only did they go into the religious institutions and then work, they built a whole black economy, because they're not allowed to declare that they're working. Because if they declare they're working, then they should be drafted, because then they're not inside the religious institution. So it became much worse in that sense. So it's already on the table now. It's the awareness that so many of them are declaring that they're going into the religious institution when actually they're not. They're working. But they're even working under the table so that they're not paying taxes. And yet they're getting all the social benefits. I want to be clear, the ultra-Orthodox are poor. This isn't about they're taking this and turning it into becoming rich. And they don't like being poor. The two segments of Israeli society, it's a direct correlation and it's a very sad one, the poor in Israeli society are the Arab citizens of Israel and the ultra-Orthodox Jews. Those are the poor of Israeli society. So there's already, we know how to find out if they are or aren't, but it's, do you want to do that or do you want to do it in dialogue? The way you need to engage, need to. The way we understand that you can engage inside these societies, because they are run very much by the religious figure who leads the community, is that you want to engage the religious leaders. You want to get them on board. And I hate to put it in those terms, no matter what, but it's what the priest said, it's what the rabbi said, and if he says yes, I'll go, and if he says no, I won't go. So they're trying to engage the religious figures. And there's great diversity between the different ultra-Orthodox religious figures on how they look at the military service. So it isn't an easy answer that I, because what's going to happen at the end is some will be drafted willingly and some won't. And they'll make accommodations for some. But the IDF as a system right now has already stated that for them to accommodate thousands of ultra-Orthodox men soldiers a year, you have to realign the IDF. So, again, it's the I don't think of that as being the problem. We know how to find that out. We're small. You see it.
As a quick follow-up to that, then we'll get to your question. Is conscientious objection allowed in the way that it is here in the U.S.? Because in some sense, declaring that you are religious is a conscientious objection, but not at all in the same way.
Eric has to touch upon the open sore. No, it's not allowed. Okay, if you stand up and you say that you're a pacifist, okay, you're against war, against military, in Israel you will be put in jail. There's an accumulation of jail time that they'll do, and then at the end they will be let out, but they'll be let out with the Ot Kain, with Kain, Cain, what's the...
Mark of Cain.
The Mark of Cain. Because they'll be giving a psychological...
Seriously?
No. They'll be given out... We're not like that, right? You have to see my sense of humor, right? But they'll be let out at the end with a psychological profile that says that they can't serve, which used to mean a lot in Israel. It doesn't as much now. But once upon a time, if you wanted to afterwards both get into university, but also especially when you get into jobs, and why didn't you serve in the military? And the answer would be, because I got a psychological profile... is going, oh, okay, I'm not sure I'm going to hire you. So they would get off on that at the end, but that's only after they would sell serious jail time. I'm not talking about 2 weeks. I mean, they'll accumulative probably sit in jail time between 6 months to a year on the fact that they're objecting to the terms of, it can be, they can say occupation policies, whatever it is, but we don't have that, no? But when it comes to religious, we do have it. Certainly for the women and for the ultra-Orthodox men, but not for...
Interesting. Okay. Yeah, there's a question.
Yeah, my question. Oh, did you want
no.
Okay. My question was actually about the women, because you said, you know, the numbers aren't very high right now. But as they get higher, do you think that there's a possibility? Because if there's a basic law of full equality, that even the Orthodox and ultra-Orthodox women will have to serve at some point, perhaps in full women battalions or something of that sort.
So first of all, the modern Orthodox women, instead of military service, what Israel has offered for over 50 years, it wasn't from the beginning. But what we've offered is national service, which again, these are things that you don't have at all. And when I talk about that worldwide, you know, people always say, we're the exception, but we're the exception. There isn't anything like that. And they do full equivalent service as modern Orthodox women, modern Orthodox. But they don't do it in the military. And what Israel has established over the last, really, 50 years is that women and men, by the way, of the conscientious, they've tried to put it into there to kind of find a place where you can let it out without it being so politically controversial, is to be teachers at schools, you know, like in hard schools and places where you need it. To be in the police force, because the police force always needs additional kind of help. In hospitals... So I said schools, hospitals, police force. What am I missing out on? I'm missing out on one of them. But those are the segments where you can do national service instead of military service. With women, it's a real choice, meaning you don't even have to show that you're modern Orthodox. If you stand up and say, I can't do military service, but I'm going to do national service, that kind of, even though it's harder to do military service than national service, they're doing full 2 year or 3 years of service. Okay, and it's accredited with all of the benefits. So that's why the women's number is 50% as opposed to the almost 70% of the men. That's pretty much the gap there.
Mm-hmm.
An interesting aspect of the education side to it is the Haredi women, which are the ultra-Orthodox women, this isn't applying to them. And the ultra-Orthodox in Israel have the highest birth rates, together with one segment of the Arab citizens of Israel. There's one segment that have very high birth rates, but the ultra-Orthodox is sitting down, right? Average family, 6.1 kids. Average family. those are the ones that are on the... And the women, are not allowed in high school to study within their own society, within the own way that they look at it. They're not allowed to study the real religious studies because they're women. Just, I'm not going to give my opinion on that one, but okay, as I said, each to his own society. But because they're not allowed to study the religious studies, they actually get a quite solid semi-secular education that the men don't get, okay? Because the men are in religious studies. And afterwards, they're unemployable because of that. So that the women are not drafted into the military. They're getting married quite young. They're going to have that 6.1 children. And yet, in the ultra-Orthodox community, the women are the ones who work. Because they've had a semi-secular education so that they're employable.
Yeah.
So
Alan, and then...
Just two brief questions. Are there Ashkenazi Sephardic conflicts within the IDF? And the second is, what happens, like, typical Russian immigrant, age 35 or 40, comes to Israel? What about military service? Okay. Or something like that?
Okay, so it's two different things. I'm going to start with the Sephardic Ashkenazi. I'll go backwards because I'm going to assume that most of the people here don't necessarily know what Sephardic and Ashkenazi are. I'm going to give the worst comparison, and I'm going to say that it's Catholicism and Orthodox, okay? Both Christian, okay? Very different. And yet, both Christian, okay? And I'm doing it in those terms because to me it's the easiest way. They're both Jews. It's pretty much Jews that originated in Spain and then in the Inquisition, and after the Inquisition with the expulsion from Spain, that's the one type of Jewish life. And they're just as, both agree that the others are Jewish. The pioneers of Zionism, of the idea of Jewish nationhood, the ones who established and managed to establish the modern state of Israel, the ones who came and reestablished, I mean, there had always been a small Jewish presence, but the ones that came and reestablished a bigger Jewish presence, and the ones that again brought about the modern day of Israel, were the Ashkenazi, which you kind of call the Western Jews. Overwhelmingly in North America, what you meet are Ashkenazi Jews. Sephardic Jews, there are communities in Canada, like Montreal has quite a significant one. There are other communities in North America, but overwhelmingly, you have met Ashkenazi Jews. You just don't even know them. And Sephardic Jews are the Balkans and Turkey, like the Bulgarian Jews, the Greek Jews, the Turkish Jews, and all of the Middle Eastern Jews in general. The ones that used to live, because they were all kicked out, from Iraq, Syria, Morocco, Libya, and all of those different Jewish communities that were kicked out systematically after the establishment of the State of Israel. And what happened in Israel because of that is that the Ashkenazis are the WASPs. Okay? That gives you a really good standing. You were the ones who established. You have a stronger... So what, the other ones... I'm really going to stick my foot in my mouth, right? Okay? But the ones who come later on, have they done as well? You know, some better, some worse. But it gives you... And in Israel, at the end, we're only 65 years as a state. And the ones who were prior to the establishment of the state were overwhelmingly the Ashkenazi. So certainly for the first 45 years, the officers were the Ashkenazi kibbutz men. Because all of the kibbutzim were overwhelmingly Ashkenazi, okay? But that was once upon a time, Alan. And that has totally changed. And it's changed. In the military, nobody notices it. It really is kind of a non-issue what your background is, because in the military, it's an equalizer. And I'll just mention the fact that former defense minister, who before that was the chief of staff, was a 9-year-old immigrant from Persia, Sephardic, called Shaul Mufaz. And so he became the chief of staff. And it's not necessarily the exception. When you look at the chief of staff, at the major generals within the staff command in Israel, half are Ashkenazi and half are Sephardic. It becomes a non-issue. So that's the one thing where it was out there. Remind me of what the second one was. I forgot the...
What happens if you come to Israel as a 30
right.
or 40-year-old?
Do you
retroactive?
So until 20 years ago, with the big immigration from the immigration from the Soviet Union was 1990 until 1999. We don't have mass immigration anymore from the former Soviet Union. The largest immigration numbers that we're getting right now are from different European countries where anti-Semitism is on the rise. Last year, our largest community that grew was from French Jews. That was the largest, 30,000 French Jews immigrated to Israel last year, and that's part of the challenges that we have worldwide with all sorts of different issues. But when it comes to Israel, right now, and that's different than in the past, if you immigrate up to the age of 24, you will do military or some military service, not necessarily the full 3 years or 6 months. But if you're older than 24, and that's true men and women, but if you're older than 24, then you don't do military service anymore. And it's a big point of contention. Because the military is so much part of Israeli culture, again, not in the militaristic manner, but it is a big social issue. It's like going to college. It's where you make your friends for life. It's where you have a social interaction that you're meeting people from different backgrounds and they become who you are. It's giving you responsibility, enormous responsibility at a very young age, authority, understanding. When you come onto campuses, I made this comment before, we were walking through campus and I saw two classrooms of undergraduate students. And I looked in and I joked and I said that they're really young. But it's because in Israel, you only get to college after you finish your military service. So the average undergraduate student in Israel is 23, 24, which is here already going to be a graduate student. So the classroom looks different, but it's not only that they're 23, 24. They're 23, 24 after full military service. And that changes you. It's not the same kind of background that people are coming on into. So people want to join the military, and they're frustrated by the fact sometimes that they don't. But again, there aren't 35 to 40-year-olds Russians immigrating anymore. That happened in the 1990s. Then they were incorporated, but now you're older than 24. You have to fight to be drafted, even for a short time period.
So we have a question here, and then here, and here. And okay, here, great.
You mentioned that the Arabs and the ultra-Orthodox are the poorest.
They are.
In Israel. Do the Arabs, because they cannot serve, also have a mark of Cain?
It's an excellent point, and don't use the mark of Cain anymore.
I mean, quote.
No, you're right. I'm going to definitely not use that one again. It's not
a tough one.
No, because it also it resonates so much. Okay. So until 20 years ago, Israelis who did not serve in the military, which meant whoever it was kind of like, okay, you didn't serve. It was a question also of benefits. Because when you're going to jobs in the Israeli greater system, the first thing that people ask you is what you did in the military. You didn't serve. And it's not that you have to serve, but you didn't serve. So it immediately puts you at a disadvantage. In Israel, it's an advantage that you say where I served. And usually that's going to be the people who speak up. But when you write down, why am I forgetting the name of that? Where you want to write down the people who are going to tell you about who you are. You usually do that in Israel from your military service because it's a long military service. It's 3 years for everybody. And anybody who's done officer's course adds in at least an additional year and sometimes two. Which is, again, why undergraduates in Israel are relatively old. So that for the Arab citizens of Israel, that means that they don't have that. Now, what Israelis will stay straight up is that the Arab citizens of Israel at the age of 18 were going to university. Israelis only get there when they're 21, 22.
They do go to university.
Sure. In the percentages of those, they are the disadvantaged. But disadvantaged go to university. I mean, that's not, you know, it's a smaller percentage. And what's happened in Arab society over the last, this is something that we're seeing more in the last 10 years or so, is that in Arab society, in that 21% of the citizens of the state of Israel, the women are becoming incredibly more educated than the men. Now, both are not drafted, okay? But the women, at the age of 18, are going to university. They have much higher achievement capabilities in the testing in Israel. And there's all sorts of things they're trying to look at. That's a whole different issue. Because in Israel, we have four official education systems that are paid for by the government, and the 21% Arab-speaking Israelis are in an education system which is in Arabic. Arabic is an official language in Israel. They don't study in Hebrew. They study in Arabic, which is their native language, and it's an official language in the state of Israel. And one of the things that they wonder about, the fact that they don't do as well in school because they do the exact same curriculum, and in Arabic is why? Are the teachers not as good? But that's a different issue. When it comes to that age right now, I'll just give you a few things that happen. One, they don't get the tax benefits that you get when you serve in the military. The military gives you tax benefits. So that's a side that you want to serve. Now, they're allowed to volunteer. They're not drafted, but they're allowed to volunteer. Of the Arab speaking,
volunteers to fight or volunteers?
Volunteer for full military service. But they're not drafted. There's a distinct difference between people who are drafted or who volunteer. And what's happened at the beginning of the establishment of the state, 1948, when the state was established, when they initiated the draft, there were two sections of minorities in Israeli society where in dialogue, they said we're part of Israeli society. We're part of the Israeli state. We want to be drafted, and they've drafted the men from the beginning, really from still in the war in 1948. That's the Druze community. The Druze men are drafted and have been from the beginning. And the second, if you ever heard of the Circassian community, wow, it's like, you know, talk about minorities. The Circassians are Russian Sunni Muslims who were persecuted by Russian Orthodox tsars, and they left Russian Orthodox tsarism to the Turkish Ottoman Empire. And we have Circassian communities. They're Sunni, not Shiite, because the ones that are the extreme ones that you see now that want to do Itzelchi and everything, those are Shiites. These are Sunnis. You have Circassian communities in Syria and Israel and in Jordan. In each one of the places, like the Druze, they are active member nation of the state that they're in. So we have a Circassian community, and the men have been drafted from the beginning so that they're Russian Orthodox, speaking Russian, Muslim, talk about. So you have, it's a small number, but that's part of the differences, and I lost my thread of thought, but I gave the answer.
I think you covered a lot of it, yeah.
Okay.
We have 10 or 15 minutes left, so, yeah.
To follow up on Professor Wolf's question, the picture behind me, you have modern Orthodox. You can see Ashkenazi and Sephardi in the picture. You also have Ethiopian Jews in the picture who are recent immigrants. Can you talk about their integration, both into Israeli society and into the military specifically?
Israel was established in 1948, and the pioneers who came and built the communities that based upon them you could declare the modern state of Israel in 1948 were overwhelmingly Ashkenazi, and a lot of them were what I called the secular traditional Jews, meaning they were non-practicing Jews. When the state of Israel was established in 1948, the Arab countries gradually, it didn't happen one night overnight, but gradually over a time period of almost 15 years, kicked out all of the Jews who had lived in the different Arab countries surrounding the state of Israel, both directly neighbors and further away. In 1948, the Yemenite community was the first to kind of, and they were actually airlifted, okay? It was like 50,000 people that were airlifted from Yemen to Israel and brought on and in because they were persecuted. I think that now there are like 8 Yemenite Jews left in Yemen. And then as the years went on, with all the continuation of the friction of the violence, the Egyptian Jews, the Syrian Jews, the Persian Jews, the Iraqi Jews were a really big community, and they all left without anything. The Ethiopian Jews, who were Jews through and through, but if I said Ashkenazi and Sephardic, the Ethiopians are an additional group, and there are a few other ones that are also small, which means that they're accepted as Jews, but they have their own traditions and background and language and culture. That's also Amharic, which is the Ethiopian language, but everybody at the end works with Hebrew. And because of the conditions in Ethiopia, the Israelis reached out, and from the 1980s, the mid-1980s until 1991, approximately a little under 200,000 Ethiopian Jews were, some of them walked and then were flown in. And in 1991, there was this enormous airlift, and they became part of Israel. But it was the first time in modern-day Israel that communities came that were really, I need a term that won't be derogatory, that were challenged by modern society. The Ethiopian Jews in Ethiopia were shepherds, were rural agricultural farmers who farmed the way you farmed 2,000 years ago. It rains, you have water. You hope that you have for the thing that's in the, I'm forgetting the name of that, where
plow.
You do, the plow, that you have a donkey with a plow or a horse with a plow or a person with a plow, but we're not talking about tractors. And the construction of their society, and you see in that sense here, was very much one of the elders. And the elders were A to Z, the men elders. They ran society. They were the heads of the Jewish community. They were the ones who gave the ruling within both the religious life and within their whole sociological life in Ethiopia. And they came to Israel, and they wanted to come to Israel. By the way, they didn't call Israel Israel. They call Israel Jerusalem. Okay, they were going to Jerusalem because Jerusalem was going up. It's a whole term within their life, which is about, it's very, in that sense, with a very strong Christian also. I mean, and Ethiopia itself has such an amazing Christian community. And in that sense, they were going up to Jerusalem, okay? And they arrived in Israel mid-1980s until 1991, and their society was put on its head because the elders found it the hardest in this new modern Western society. And I'm talking about people who really, they'd never lived inside houses. They'd never had modern plumbing. They'd certainly never met electricity. Now you think about that and about integration, and then there's always that question, so do you leave them the way they were in Ethiopia? They've come into Israeli society. And the elders not only lost their standing, they lost everything. Because who learns the language the fastest? The 5-year-old kid, okay? The 10-year-old. And then the 10-year-old becomes the translator for the elders. And you don't have, so that whole society was put upon its head. And what happened in the 1990s is that most of the Ethiopian youth were put into youth programs, not to take them away from their family because their family was bad, but actually in the idea of trying to give them the advantage of learning the modern world, but it just made it even, you know, harder and more challenging. And the military became an equalizer because they were drafted into the military. And that generation of the 5 and 10-year-olds who were then drafted into the military became officers or in the infantry. I mean, they're very much in the different fighting units. So we're at the stage right now that our last beauty queen was is a lovely Ethiopian, gorgeous woman who's from that background. The last Israeli-American idol, which is the Israeli idol, the last one who won, is a lovely young Ethiopian woman. I mean, so you see that generation is integrated. And they're the ones who have gone through military service. And here, there's all sorts of additional aspects, because in Israel, we have recognition of Ashkenazi Jews and of Sephardic Jews. And because of that, we have a chief Ashkenazi rabbi and a chief Sephardic rabbi. But the Ethiopians are something else. And they came in, and the elders lost their whole stature, and they asked to have recognition of their elders as being a third, it's actually a fourth, because the Yemenites had their own. And everybody was like, because they couldn't even talk. It was, you know, the whole dialogue was very challenging. So that's part of where we are right now. So they are both integrated and not integrated. The biggest challenge there is that the parents' generation cannot help the children. And it's a challenge in every underprivileged society. And there's always going to be that question of how much you do it for them, and then what happens. So we have a lot of programs that's not in the military. It's actually programs that are in all the colleges in Israel, which you would kind of call Big Brother programs, the equivalent of. And the main focus of them is the Ethiopian youth that need an elder that can be part of modern society because they're not getting that at home. Their parents can't help them, and math can't help, you know, like all of the different types of things. And so then we have a whole program for that. So I addressed it both ways. But the women are mainly modern Orthodox, so a lot of them don't serve. They'll do other type of service, but there are those who serve in the same way.
Okay, we'll see if we can get David, and there's one more question here before we go.
Yeah, I've actually got two. One is, what led you personally to go from being drafted to deciding to stay on, and what sort of challenges did you face in terms of rising to the rank of colonel? That's the first question. Second one is, well, what is a different question as well? Well, what is the, how would you describe the sort of religious life within the military in terms of the role of chaplaincy, church services, sorry, not church services, but religious services and so on?
Okay. Is there one more question? I'll just hear it and that
yeah,
way I'll be
ahead,
able to address them all.
That's great.
Sure.
Yeah, different topic would be, a number of years ago there was a report about the successes of women in the training regimen, and just if you could address the future of that with ultra-Orthodox.
So I'm going to do 1, 2, and I'm going to end at the end with my own personal story, and that way it'll be easiest to end on that. Okay, so in Israel, virtually all of the training is done by women NCOs, and then women officers, and the issue at stake is, do you build an ultra-Orthodox core instead to train the ultra-Orthodox, or just men to train the ultra-Orthodox? And again, that's one of the issues which hasn't yet been dealt with because they haven't yet drafted them. But the IDF says that at any stage along the way that they decide that, let's say from 2014, the way the draft works in Israel, because it works with the high school year, because it's 18-year-olds, you're not drafted when you're 18. Everybody, it's like the class of 2014 that will finish in June of 2014 will start being drafted from July 2014 until March 2015. And you get your date depending on what unit you're going to, and so on and so forth, okay? And there's like waves of draft. There's the July-August draft, and then there's the November draft, which is a really big one, and then there's the February-March draft. And each one of the units builds itself that way. And the question is, if they're going to draft in the summer of 2014 10,000 ultra-Orthodox men, you have to build the training corps to be able to train them. So I put as it a question that hasn't yet been resolved. It's been discussed within the IDF, and it's something that they're going to have to see if they use the backbone of the ultra-Orthodox units that exist now and take them out and turn them into training corps, because they already exist, rather than being fighting battalions, which they are now. Or if you train additional men, because the training corps of all of them, of infantry, armored, artillery, of everything, is all based on women. So I don't yet know what the resolution of that will be. So that was one. What was the second one that you had asked there?
The nature of the religious life, chaplaincy.
So in Israel, I'll make a very strong statement. We do not have separation of religion and state in the state of Israel. In the military, there is a unit which is the military rabbinical unit. And they are essentially responsible for giving the religious services for the Jews. Now, there are Christians, there are Druze, there are Muslims. As I said, there are Bedouins, there are those who do volunteer. And they'll each have their own recognition of what they need. But because there's a unit, which is the rabbinical unit, the emphasis is on the Jewishness. And what they do is they do the following. One, all of the IDF, all of the Israeli Defense Forces, even though most of the people are, as we said, non-practicing Jews, all of the IDF adheres to strict kashrut, which is the food laws, the separation of milk, and all of the IDF. Because it's kind of like, that way everybody can eat. It's not like nobody, even if you don't eat kosher, you'll eat the food that's kosher. So it won't be your steak in butter, okay? You'll have it in margarine. I mean, well, whatever, right? You don't have steak in the army anyways. But when we our cheeseburger, lack of cheeseburger in the military, okay? And so that's one aspect, is that they did it overall and they supervised that. I want to give the following example. My husband and I have both served. My husband still serves. He's also a full colonel. And he served at one stage along the way. His division commander was Druze. Druze, okay? We would come in on the weekends when my husband stayed at the base. In Israel, you don't have, you know, away and close and all the different things. It's very different. And so on the weekends that he would stay every third weekend at the base, and I would come up with the kids. And on the Friday night dinner, you would say the blessings, everybody who stayed. The head of the table was the Druze commander, and you're singing the Jewish blessing over whatever, and the Druze commander, what everybody would have on the head covering, you'd say that, and most of the people in the room were Druze, Bedouin, and non-practicing Jews, but you do that. It's like and again, it's done from a heritage cultural point of view. Having said that, this trend of the modern Orthodox becoming more conservative and trying to impose more limitations is one which is very challenging within the military. So that they mainly do the supervision of the rituals themselves, but they're also the ones who will sing the Friday night prayers, who will run the Saturday. Nobody goes to the synagogue. Every base has a synagogue. And as I said, it's the synagogue they don't go to is the Orthodox one. So the few that do go into it, they'll run the prayers. But they won't allow any vehicles drive around a base on a Saturday except for operational use. Meaning, of course, if you have to, you have to. But you can't just drive in and out. It's a balance. As I say, it's always a question. I'll end with myself, right? I never expected to do a military career. I was you guys. I was going to study poli-sci, and then I was going to go do my dissertation, right? Okay. Or whatever. Or maybe be in the diplomatic corps. I was drafted into military intelligence. When I was drafted in 1980, I've already said, you know my age, okay, I'm 51, right? When I was drafted in 1980, 2 years before the first Lebanon War, okay, women did not have opportunities of what I talked about, the changes that have happened. And the most combat that you could be was combat support, was military intelligence. And I was thrilled by the fact that I was drafted into military intelligence at the time, because in the 1980s, 85 to 90% of the women were doing clerical positions. And the fact that I went into what was very much not a clerical position, but a military intelligence in what we call the intelligence gathering community, I was thrilled. And then I fought to go to officer's course. And when I fought to go to officer's course, that's part of the vision with Inside Israel, that when you get interviewed for a job in that sense, okay, being an MI, military intelligence, that's good. If you're an officer, that's even better. And just like you guys were probably to get into, you know, BC, you were on the student body and did all sorts of extracurricular things. In Israel, you go to officer's course to serve, and you also do it because you know that that service is something beneficiary afterwards. And I went to officer's course. I finished officer's course 3 weeks before the first Lebanon War. I was a second lieutenant in the first Lebanon War. My officer's training in Israel, the way that it's done, is that you are always a soldier before you're an officer. We don't have a West Point. We don't have those kind of things. First you're a soldier, and then they send you to officer's training. And the age group that I was then, I was 19, I was 20 at that time group, and the officers that we all trained together, when I did officer's training in 1981, I finished in 1982, we were 150 in the military intelligence officers training, of which we were 8 women. Okay, it was really nice. Okay. And I was 1920, right? That time period, right? And I served for an additional year as a military intelligence officer, including during the first Lebanon War itself, and that's all things that kind of, you know, mixed up. And then I got out, just like most Israelis do. As I said, you sign on extra when you go to officers training. I did my officers. And I got out and I went to do my undergraduate degree. And while I was studying my undergraduate degree at Tel Aviv University, and I was thinking that I'm going to go into the diplomatic corps and I'm going to try and go into whatever, you know, the back into university, I turned around and I thought, okay, actually, I'm going to go back into MI. I like the intelligence work. I think that people who are in it, it's very addictive. It's not nice nowadays to talk about drug addictions. The last, you know, few days, drug addictions are a very negative thing, but it's always a negative thing, but military intelligence is very addictive. That sense of trying to find out information that whoever you're looking at is not trying to know that information, of putting the pieces together and of trying to create some kind of an idea and of being very much within it, and I liked it. I liked it when I was in service, so I finished my undergraduate degree and I went back into the military. And from then, I just flowed with what I was offered. And because I was a woman in a very, very manly world, in a world with no women at all when I went back in. I mean, certainly in the early 1980s, and then when I went back in, every position I did from the minute I went back in was the first time a woman had done that position. And I did a series of positions in military intelligence, and every time I did it, it was kind of like, this is interesting, okay, I'll do another one. And for people who have ants in their pants, military in general is in Israel is a great kind of thing because you don't stay in the same position. You do a year or two and then you do something else. And when you have ants in your pants, it's very nice. And I'm certainly, as you can see, I'm all bouncy and out and about. And I did that until child number one was born. Married. And when I was a lieutenant colonel, I had child number one. With child number one, I ignored the fact that I had a kid. When he was 11 months old, I was at the time the G2 of a division. I was the intelligence officer of an airborne division, which is, there hasn't been a woman since. When I was the S2, when I was the intelligence officer of a brigade, there have been like 3 women since, and I did that over 20 years ago. I find it very sad in that sense. There hasn't been a woman since as an intelligence officer of a division at all in Israel. And when he was like 11 months old, I had a divisional operation, and I wasn't home for 10 days, and an 11-month baby, when you're not home for 10 days and you come home, doesn't recognize you, your mom, okay? So that did something. When I became pregnant with child number two, I was already a full colonel. And I treated it differently, and the military treated it differently. And it's very challenging in every society. And the military looked at me and said, oh God, you're really disappointing. And I looked at the military and said, you know, I don't actually think you say that to any of the men who have kids. Because it's very visual also, because we don't have maternity uniforms, which is fine. Who wants a maternity uniform? But it means that I was pregnant with 3 kids in a row, and for years I didn't wear a uniform, and uniform is very much a part of military life and status. And nobody believes I'm a colonel anyways, right? You know, like, what woman colonel? And there I am and with this big stomach. So after she was born, the military and I started to part our ways. And when I became pregnant with child number 3, I went physically from maternity leave to pension leave, and I moved to Boston for a year. And so when I say the choices, I really liked what I did. I think the balance in military for everybody is very challenging, for women more, both because we're on our own, and it's very paternal, and it's very kind of like, you do the work, that's fine, but if you don't stay until 11 p.m., that's not fine, and if you finished it at 7 p.m. and you want to go home, you still have to stay until 11 p.m. because people have to see you, and it was very challenging, and my husband's still in the military, and we have three kids, and they're not in the military. And, they will.
Yeah, yeah.
The eldest will be drafted in a few years. And that's part of Israel. There's an unwritten contract in Israel that underlines everything that we talk about with the military. That we send our children to be drafted. And that the military will take care of them. Okay? And stuff happens in the military. It's not an easy environment. And that's part of Israeli society. Again, with the exception of two segments. So really, you guys got to go back to work and to whatever you do and to study. And
this has not only given us the sort of...
Yeah.